welcome to Minute 39 of the Great Escape Minute, the daily podcast where we dig into the Great Escape 1 minute at a time. I'm Tom.
And I'm Rob.
And joining us again today is Jim O'Kane from Rocketeer Apollo 13 Minute Podcast, as well as a handful of others. How you doing today, Jim?
Doing good, doing good. Enjoying this movie, every minute of this movie, like you are. But I'm out on Friday, so we'll let you keep going.
But then you get to listen to it all.
Yeah, so that's true. Too. That's the exciting part. I'll let you talk about the midnight. It's weird being a guest because you're like, I get to sit back and let you guys do the heavy lifting.
Yes. So minute 39 starts with Headley asking what kind. And it ends with the Germans closing up the camp. So I tried to figure out, you know, the specs on this camera and how it works compared to modern cameras. And so, as I say, Colin says he wants a 35mm f2.8 with a focal plane shutter. I started trying to research this and realized that I do not have a base level of camera knowledge, you know, sufficient enough to really research this before I, you know, and I wasn't prepared to go down hours and hours of rabbit holes trying to figure out camera knowledge. So if either of you have any knowledge on cameras and, yeah, can share some insight, it'd be much appreciated.
Well, I don't specifically have knowledge on cameras, but the research that I was able to do was that there were cameras of that type available at the time. There was something called the Leica model of the Leica camera. So they had models 1, 2, and 3, and all of them had focal plane shutters. Now I don't know what that means.
Yes. Well, let me help you guys, because my bachelor's degree was in film production. Oh. And had to do 2 courses on the history of motion pictures, which also involved the history of photography. Leica cameras are German cameras that really revolutionized modern photography. A lot of the things that we come to expect in of a camera were developed by the development of a Leica camera. They were mostly built in the 20s and 30s. Well, actually, they started around the 1910s, but the 20s and 30s, they got better and better at it. Cameras, in order to make them usable, was you needed to have high-definition film that you could blow up to make, you know, the idea of where you enlarge pictures and you can make, you know, big 16 by 20 pictures. And in order to do that, you needed 2 things. You needed a really good film, and you also needed really good lenses. The lenses had to be carefully ground, and nobody had better optics than the Germans. The Germans had companies like Zeiss and companies like Leica, where they built very complicated multi-lens camera bodies that could or lenses that were a series of glass plates, different convex and concave glass lenses that they put into a lens system. And you had to be able to refine the focus to a very small you had to the technical term was circles of confusion. You had to make very small circles of confusion so that you had high resolution image that would appear on a high resolution film, so you could blow it up big. Zeiss and Leica worked on the lens portion. Another company, a chemical company called Agfa, which also owned an American company called Ansco. Agfa built a high-resolution film that could compete with Kodak. So with Agfa film, or Ansco film, combined with Leica and Zeiss lenses, you could make a very small camera that could make really great high-definition pictures from a very small, a 35mm target area on a film. Leica was very popular. The camera that he's asking for is a German Leica camera here. At the time, Leica was having problems because most of the people that worked for Leica
were out on the battlefields.
Well, either that or they were Jewish and they had emigrated to get away from Germany. And if they were lucky, yeah. I mean, but the thing was, I've forgotten the fellow's name. The fellow that ran Leica had hired many Jewish engineers pre-war. And as the Nazis moved in, he was building what they called freedom flights. He was flying his employees, Jewish employees, out of Germany to England, to America, to Canada, and putting them in American ANSCO factories so they could work in the Americas, so that when the war finally broke out, all these people that had worked with him were safe. And as a result, you know, I mean, this gigantic brain drain, the Nazis didn't have many engineers who could handle optics because they had chased everybody or put people in camps. So they didn't have, like, the wartime Leicas that were built in Germany were nothing like the pre-war Leica lenses and films. And as a result, a lot of the Leica folks had gone to work for British intelligence to build photo reconnaissance stuff that Colin was probably using when he was working on his photo reconnaissance thing. He had these great exiled German engineers working with him for better focal lenses. And they were starting to work on things like infrared, so they could build infrared cameras which have a different focal plane. But since the wavelengths are longer, you have to change the focus for using infrared, but they could do heat images to see where things were, like engine plumes and stuff at night. They could take pictures at night photography. So a lot of the technical stuff that Colin knew about, or may have known a piece of, I don't know where he fit in the organization, but he was working with a lot of advanced technologies. And to him, saying, I need a 35 millimeter Leica was probably, yeah, that's standard operating procedure for my job. But for Hanley, trying to find a pre-war Leica, a lot of them had been basically requisitioned by the Nazis because they didn't have the equipment that they needed to do photo reconnaissance and just simple recording measures, because the people that worked for Zeiss and Leica were either exiled or dead. It's just an interesting little subset of what was going on in this war. But you know, he asking for a Leica camera was not going to be an easy call. I mean, I'm assuming, you know, he's going to be
well. Apparently, they get it pretty easily later on.
Yeah. Apparently, Fritz had one at home. So it's but it's, you know, it's just a. It's there's a whole book in that in itself. I mean, you can talk all about the technology there. I love learning about the technology of World War II and what played for and against the Germans and for the Allies. I mean, there's so much stuff that fell into the Allies' hands simply because Hitler was chasing all these smart people out of the country. We usually think of atomic scientists and things like that, but it was stuff like optics and chemistry and biowarfare and electronics. I'm currently reading a book called 12 Seconds of Silence. It's about building proximity fuses that would fight the V1. This is going a little bit off the rails, but it's an interesting thing about World War II technology. The V1, the buzz bomb, the doodle bug that was sent to destroy British, you know, basically destroy London, other things like anti-aircraft, being able to shoot planes out of the sky. The way before the war, the only way to shoot down planes out of the sky was you set a fuse, a timer fuse, in an artillery shell. So you say, 15 seconds after I launch this, the shell will explode. So you try to figure out, I have to aim in the sky, and then after I shoot, I have to hope that 15 seconds from now, it's at the same altitude and roughly in the same location as an aircraft. And if you missed it, then you had to redo it all over again and set, no, I mean, maybe I now mean 12 seconds. But meanwhile, the plane's moving, so you can't. You can't shoot it. So the obvious thing there is, well, maybe if you made something that was inside the artillery shell that if it detected anything metal nearby, it would explode. And until it detected something metal nearby, it wouldn't explode. So that sounds great. It's like, okay, yeah, we can build that. But here's the problem. If you're using a cannon, any kind of, you know, a howitzer or something like that.
That in itself is metal.
Well, yeah. Well, you can, I mean, you can set it so that there's a magnetic range. So if you see there's a change in the magnetism around it, and it only turns on like 3 seconds after it leaves. But the problem is, if you're building something electronic, back then you're talking about vacuum tubes. And the artillery shell is leaving the barrel at 20,000 Gs. So trying to build something that's sturdy enough that can survive being launched out of an artillery shell at 20,000 Gs and still be able to work that it can spot nearby metal objects to blow out of the sky, that's a whole story in itself, and that took years. They didn't resolve that until like around 1943, 44.
Wow.
And I mean, the good thing about it is the Germans didn't have anything consecutive, you know, something like that. So all they had was altitude bombs. So when B-17s were flying over and you saw those flak, you know, the flak explosions, the only way that they would hit anything was just sheer luck that, you know, if something at that altitude blew up, they could shoot them down. But anti-aircraft guns barely worked. I mean, it's less than 1%, I think, was the number of, you know, shots to things knocked out of the sky.
Wow.
Well, right. No, so I looked up what you said, and it was Ernst Leitz II.
That's him, yeah.
Who was the head of the company from 1920. And after Hitler came into power in 1933, he started slowly assigning hundreds, if not thousands, of employees over to overseas offices in order to try and save all of these Jews.
It's like Schindler's List, basically.
Yeah, and they said he was able to keep it secret. And people only knew about it after he died, years after the war. And yeah, it was called the Leica Freedom Train. That's very interesting. As a Jew, it's fascinating to hear little stories like that, you know, to hear about the things that people did back then. So thank you for enlightening me on that.
Right. Yeah, no, it's an amazing story.
Yes, thank you for the camera enlightenment in general as well. And, I mean, you can almost see Henley's reaction, like he knows this is going to be a pain to find.
And no, but he's like, all right, he's up to the challenge.
Well, right, he's up to the challenge. He knows he can do it, but just his face, you can just see him going, this one's going to be a problem. You know, you can just see that this is going to be something I need to think long and hard about. How am I going to do it? Compared to when Bronson immediately comes in and goes, I need a big, heavy pick. And he goes, what, only one? You know, it's just the dynamic of, all right, I've got this, you know, expensive, important camera I need to get that's going to be one of the more challenging things probably. And then, oh, I just need a big blunt object I can put holes in things with. You know, just that dynamic is something I didn't pick up on until this watching.
Right. Okay. There is something to that. It's also the idea of, you know, simple things that someone asks for, you can deal with easier than something that's a little out of the ordinary. Now, we only find out tomorrow in that minute what Colin actually does. So you'd think that at this point, Henley should be saying, okay, you want a camera, but what do you need a camera for? You know, he doesn't, because Colin, as we mentioned a few days ago, they never state what Colin does. Colin takes his usual job, whatever that usual job is. Apparently the usual job involves a camera. So
yeah, he's the unipublicist. Yeah.
Maybe.
He does the newspaper.
Yeah. But the line that I love is after Henley says all right to the camera, Colin then says, and don't forget film, of course. And he goes, of course. Now think about it. You know, a roll of film back in the 80s and 90s when I used to use film, you know, you had most film canisters had, you know, 24 pictures on them. Or whatever. I don't know what it was back in the 40s. I couldn't tell you, you know, how many you got on each film packet. But he doesn't even mention how many he needs. They're dealing with 200 documentations for 250 prisoners. So he's going to need a crap load of film. And that's not even mentioned here. I mean, later on when he gets the stuff from Werner, you know, he doesn't say to him, okay, I need a camera, and I also need, give me 500, give me, you know, 100 rolls of film so that I can take 500 roll pictures. So that, I mean, that's something, obviously, they're not going to explain this type of thing in the movie, but it sounds as if it's a little, they're going a little overboard with the number of pictures that they're going to be needing here from one particular camera.
Yeah, and he hasn't asked anything about, like, developer or fixer or, you know, anything. He's going to need something. Like, I'm assuming that he can get sodium citrate for the stop bath. He could probably, you know, use vinegar or something. But he hasn't – if he's going to be making, like, fake passports and stuff, wouldn't you also ask for, well, I'm going to need three trays and I'm going to need a developer? And you know, but he just kind of skips over that. And I would think developer stuff would be a little bit difficult to get during wartime.
Maybe that stuff that he has in his suitcase.
Okay, yeah,
there we go.
And now you mentioned before, Tom, that Danny shows up and asks for a big pick. Now, how does Danny know where Henley's room is? You know, they all just got there. It's not like everyone knows what room everyone's in. You know, it's not like they have room assignments and you can look on a chart and say, oh, Henley's in barracks 104, room 33.
You know, well, but when we get to the end of the minute, Danny's in the, you know, bigger bunk room. So if Danny's also in the same hut, he probably just saw Henley come in.
Right. Okay. There could be. But again, we don't know that yet. You know.
Yeah.
And then we go back to T.
And we go back to T and we get the first indications of Colin's eyesight. Not necessarily being what it should be. We see him pouring the tea, but as he's finishing pouring, we see his head, you know. I don't know why I keep wanting to imitate things on an audio podcast, but, you know, we see him try to duck his head in to get a better view of, you know, is my cup full yet? So we just get those little seeds planted of maybe his eyesight isn't that good.
Is it checking if his cup is full or is checking to see how his tea leaves are?
Six of one, half dozen of the other.
Okay.
I can't I don't know the process of making tea well enough to know.
Well, making tea is not making gourmet tea, maybe, but making normal tea is you have a tea bag and hot water.
Yeah. Wash some leaves at the bed.
Exactly. And then his comment about having tea without milk is so uncivilized, you know. And then Henley basically says, all right, I'm going to go get the wood for the fireplace. I've had enough talking about tea.
I need a break from you.
Let's change the subject.
And we do get, as he goes into the next scene where he's going to get the wood, I had to watch this three times before I noticed where the milk is. We get that little clue as Henley's going to eat the milk, he glances over at the two guys sitting at their teapot with the milk.
Yeah, that's right.
And we'll talk about that more tomorrow, but yeah, you know, I could never figure out, like, where did the milk come from? But fortunately, looking at this like it's the Zapruder film, you get to go frame by frame and go, oh, there's the milk. It's right there on the table.
As long as the milk isn't exploding when you watch it in slow motion, it's fine.
Oh, please. Yeah, but it's a... it's there under all those lights, or that seems to be the one light that has so many different shadows.
Right, well, and you see Willie and someone else sitting at the table. You know, Willie's just staring into space, and the other guy seems to be like writing a letter or something like that.
And I was surprised, and really throughout this whole film, whenever we're in a common room, we do not see a single deck of cards. I would just inherently think that, well, first off, why is the wood in a bunkhouse and not in, like, the hallway or a common room? But you would think these guys would be sitting around the table playing cards at some point in this movie.
Did the Brits do that as much as Americans?
I
don't know.
I would assume that.
Maybe they'd be playing cribbage or something, or whist or anything.
Right, maybe. Bridge, okay, whist, cribbage, some sort of solitaire. I mean, just some sort of card game seems like it would be normal in something like this. But
maybe Sturgis was afraid that the actors would start gambling all the time if he brought decks of cards on the set, so he stayed away from it, you know, in the middle of Bavaria, so they don't have to worry about, you know, going to try and find the deck of cards.
or they may have lost them when they all send in their uniforms to get dry cleaned every night. And left them in a pocket somewhere. The thing that bothers me with this is, yes, there is a POW camp, but they all have perfectly coiffed hair, and they're all like the Everly Brothers, you know, early 60s. None of them said, well, I'm not going to cut my hair for this movie. And they've all got these massive, they look like they're going to show up on 77th Sunset Strip or you know, some other 50s TV show. They've all these massive, like, DA cuts. They all look like the Fonz. And it's like, that is not a 1943 British cut. But
I guess that wasn't in the actor's contracts that they needed to get a
proper haircuts.
My assumption is that the real characters that these were all based on were, I think that I've heard that that's one of the complaints that's among the many complaints that the people connected to the real prisoners, you know, they weren't too happy with this movie, obviously. But I think that was one of their complaints also, that everyone looks like they're having too good of a time.
Yeah. oh well, it's just a movie. You know, it's the wrong thing to say, but yeah, it's just a movie.
Right. Sure. But it's the movie. No.
Yeah.
it's one of the movies.
Yes, it is one of the movies that has been created at some point in human history. Well, do either of you have anything else for this minute?
Nope, I'm good.
Good minute. Very good minute.
Yes. Well, Jim, you want to tell everyone where they can find you on the internet?
Sure. If you want to follow all my other stuff, I've got an easy site to go to so that you don't have to crawl around looking for things. If you go to jimokane.com, that's JIMOKANE.com. It's kind of my list of all the different podcasts that I've created or produced or been an accomplice for. So just go there and you can crawl through my life online.
All right. And while you're checking out all of Jim's other works, make sure you subscribe to our podcast and give us a 5-star review on whichever podcatcher you use. If you want to get in touch with us, our email address is thegreatminute@gmail.com. You can join our Facebook group, The Cooler. You can follow us on Twitter @GreatEscapeMXM. Or you can go ahead and just check out our website, thegreatescapeminute.com. Until tomorrow, tally-ho.
Tally-ho.
Tally-ho.